Hello and welcome to Cavaliers Do Cinema. Joe Wright has a new adaptation of Anna Karenina out. I'm not seeing it because I'm currently reading Anna Karenina and I don't like Joe Wright. Christian is seeing it because he hasn't read Anna Karenina and likes Joe Wright. Let's talk about adaptations after that gross oversimplification.
Well, yes, essentially.
But that's more or less where we're coming from.
We might explain our beef with Joe Wright first, a little bit of history to the Joe Wright situation. I like Atonement, and Sorrow, and just on the theme of adaptations, Sorrow doesn't like Atonement so much. And essentially this kind of springs from, you know, also not having read Atonement and my love for it being as a film, and also the long take is fucking awesome on the Dunkirk, on Dunkirk Beach, but Sorrow thinks that it missed the point.
Yes, well, I think the reason Atonement is the point is that it's fundamentally, it's a textual book, and this is going to become a theme that we'll talk about throughout, because it is sort of, to an extent, a bit of a postmodern-style book. We build up the character of Bryony, who is the main character, and who gives the book its title. So, you know, it is Atonement. It's about her atonement. Spoiler alert, the love story that dominates a lot of the narrative is made up, and she created it as a fantasy to make up for her wrongdoings when she was a child. Anyway, the reason the book works so well is because we are thoroughly immersed in her personality and know her so well that... And kind of are immersed in her literary way of thinking, that it just it feels more at one with where the narrative goes later on. You know, it is a story about writing and the power of fiction, and that is the central theme of the book.
And whether or not she absolves herself of any sin by writing the book.
Which, and so any book about writing, obviously you're going to have a problem when you adapt that into film.
And I mean, just on a note, Catch-22 is another film that had that problem with textuality, because so much of the book is about wordplay and, you know, like being the idea of a Catch-22 being trapped inside something that is a linguistic paradox. So, you know, to like do that on film is pretty impractical, and I have to say, I don't think the film worked. I'm not a particularly big fan of Mike Nichols either, but, you know, essentially,
And I think going back to the Atonement problem, Atonement is, it's not so much unadaptable, because it's not, I don't think it is quite at the level of Heller in terms of just the insanity of the language. It's, you know, it's actually follows a relatively conventional style compared to, you know, some of the really unadaptable books we'll be mentioning. But because it is actually, it's central to the story, and the theme is actually writing itself, you come into a big problem.
Absolutely.
When you adapt it, and I don't know, I think there's a and another thing is, I also think, the cynical part of me thinks, that they amped up the Keira Knightley love story
For bums on seats.
Bums on seats, and when that dominates,
because people like a love story, essentially.
Yeah, but when that dominates the film, you run into a problem, full stop. Because you know, the atonement that gives the story its title, it just becomes so much more relevant. And the ending, instead of feeling like just a perfect, you know, in the book it's so perfect because you don't really see it coming. It's not like, oh, I know what's going on here. But when you read it, it just makes so much sense because you've kind of come through this from Bridie's point of view. You really need to read the book.
Yes, and as someone who hasn't read it, like just from the point of view of somebody who really enjoyed the film and the just the pace and the mood of it, and I just quite enjoyed it. And I understood, I think it was in one scene where it was McAvoy, Knightley, and Romola Garai. So that was when she came back to apologise. Right. And there's this moment of with McAvoy's character where he says, "I'll be perfectly honest with you right now. I've got a good mind to either come over there and throw you down the stairs." And you're just like, this is like so British, like period drama. Like so... And it was that moment where I was just like, hang on a minute. Is this going to go... And then, like, having... With the revelation at the end being about... And that's the thing about the film. It's not about writing exactly. It's about the general kind of notion of authorship. And I mean, yes. that's one translation that is unavoidable. But, and I understood it and I got the point of everything, but the specificity of something like a book about writing is a very different thing altogether.
But so, also I find it interesting because my general people I know and have talked to about Atonement is if they've read the book, they obviously find the film, you know, doesn't quite do it justice. Or they've seen the film, liked the film, then read the book and gone, oh, it's better. But what I find weird and I don't quite understand is that ending, you know, people are fine with where, and in the book I liked it, and in the film I didn't have a problem with it per se because it was more tied into my general problems with the movie. But I would have found that a really shit ending, I think, had I not read the book, because it essentially amounts to all a dream. whereas it's set up much more nicely in the book, and also,
I mean, also visually, like it's just Vanessa Redgrave sitting in front of a black
screen, and you can really just see Joe Wright on his writer's desk going, "How do I dramatize internal monologues? Maybe I should stop doing this." And also what you mentioned about the English period drama is another slight problem I had with it. It's a period piece. It's set during the war, and it's unavoidable that when you make a film, it's going to technically be a period piece, but because
it did transcend that though with like a lot of the score and like the typewriter rhythm, which I really liked. That was a nice touch.
I was
going to
say the score is the best part of the movie.
And
for
I
me.
Do think the way like it while being a period film, like in content and like the ecology of it is very much within that time. Just the editing and the pacing of it and the score is something that does make it very obviously a contemporary film, which I did like, and it was one of the first films of that kind which was a period piece but a contemporary film and had the hallmarks of something that was made in 2005 or whenever it was.
Well, see, that's interesting because that's how I feel about the book, and I find the film regressive in that respect because, you know, when you think of period novels, so to speak, your Jane Austen's, etc. There's a distance there, like they're, you know, and you know there are fantastic 19th century and 18th century books. I'm not denying that, but what you associate with that time period is there's a certain distance to the characters and the author kind of handing them with gloves. Whereas in Atonement, Ian McEwan handles it with such intimacy and kind of it's so fully realized the world of the characters. That it's not that same kind of, you know, feeling of you're reading a quote-unquote period book. And I think you're right. Obviously, there is modern elements to the way that they attack a period piece in the film, but it's not... It's not. I don't think it transcends it as well as the book does.
Also, just another idea on just like we'll probably be mentioning this quite a lot as well. Just the ideas of just the differences between the say the book and the film is that I think that they I think in the film she's a playwright rather than a novelist.
No,
she goes into writing novels
it's
later.
Both in the
book. But I thought like if you're going to like a book about a writer writing that book.
Yeah.
If you're going to do a film of it, then logically you might change it to a director directing that, but maybe that might be. Maybe Joe Wright isn't as big of a fan of the Mel Brooks kind of school of filmmaking.
I mean, it could get ridiculous.
It could.
But I see.
I think just as a general rule, writers can write about writing a bit more than filmmakers can make films about filmmaking to a degree.
Oh, very much.
To a degree. Well, Day for Night is, you know.
No, there's good examples, but I mean, I think like half of literature to an extent features a writer of some sort as a main character. But it's also, you know, just kind of as we move on from Joe Wright, it's interesting to know. I mean, I'll probably eventually see Anna Karenina, but it looks like he's doing the same thing. And for some reason, his muse is the stiff Keira Knightley. and it looks like he's done a similar thing.
She does a pretty good pal.
Yeah, which is going to make that. But he's pushed the love story. So, you know, I think the key to Atonement is the character of Bryony.
Yep.
And he underutilizes that in the film in favor for Keira Knightley pouting. And he's going to do the same in Anna Karenina. Levin is the heart of the book of Anna Karenina. And I, you know, from what I've heard and what I've seen of kind of the, you know, trailers and reading about it, is that he's pushed away Levin in favor of love between the seductive Count Vronsky and Anna Karenina.
So moving on from just from while we're on it, the idea of like adapting
a textual
thing about of which the content is adaptation. We can move on to Charlie Kaufman's adaptation just quickly, because he's adapting a non-fiction book about nothing. I can't remember what it's called.
It's the orchid something, isn't it?
It's some... Oh, fuck, I can't remember what it's called, but basically the entire content of the film is Charlie Kaufman writing the film, and it is as bad as it would have sounded to somebody had you pitched it to them in a time before, you know, metatextual references were all right. I fucking hate Charlie Kaufman. This fanboy obsession with his movies and everything he's done pisses me off no end, and adaptation is not the worst. Cynic Ducky New York is one of the most terribly, terribly boring, novice-like films I've seen from a big director slash writer in the last 10, 15 years. I fucking hate Charlie Kaufman. And adaptation is terrible, and he actually just let us have it. I quite like to stop talking about it, perfectly honest. But
we pushed the conversation forward.
Yeah, no, it's just that kind of writing about writing is
but
terrible.
That's not right.
And it's
that's
not inherently visual. Like, there is nothing visual about that movie.
Yeah, but that's not writing about writing, that's filming about writing about writing.
Yeah, exactly. And that's one thing where just you cannot just make a film about something because it's a good idea or it's a good story or something.
It's so quirky.
It's just, if the central idea is verbal, then you can probably leave it alone and not try to make it visual. So, you know, that's verdict number one, handed down by Cavaliers Do Cinema. If you're making a film, make sure it's about something that will work visually, kids. So, you know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just not inherently the crux of it be verbal.
Or not just that, just realize it visually. I think anything can inherently be realized visually. No, I get you.
I just think, but you know, silence works, and if you drown everything, if you don't give it that breathing space, then it can kind of just die.
Yes, well, you don't like adaptation. I think the best example of an unfilmable book... the best example, I think first we should have the obligatory James Joyce mention. Because I've read Ulysses, but I haven't seen Bloom, which is there's a very hard to find early version of Ulysses, which is the first, which was deemed obscene because it had the first use of fuck. One of the first.
Oh, wow.
And then there's the more recent Irish film Bloom. I haven't watched them, and I've heard they're not awful, but, I mean, that is an But by the same token, you know, when I say unadaptable, in terms of missed opportunities, I've heard that there is a rumour of rumours, you know, there's an old legend that Eisenstein considered doing Ulysses, and because he's a modernist filmmaker in a way.
It's interesting, like, the idea of that kind of book just being adapted, because just to recall the phrase, a picture paints a thousand words, yes. And a lot of Joyce's work is the thousand words that a single picture would paint.
Yeah.
And it's to the point where, yeah, sure, you can have, like, a five-second shot of that door and, like, try to, you know, amount to a chapter of something that he's done, but you just not going to. That's why they're words, not a picture.
I mean, but if you just... I don't know. I mean... Yeah, I think it's...
Finnegan's Wake. That was adapted by...
was it?
Coppola, actually, I'm pretty sure.
No.
Yeah.
No.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Look it up now.
I am looking it up right now.
I actually think Finnegan's Wake, because it actually has, even though it has more of a plot, yeah, allegedly, because no one is actually sure if there is a plot.
I just remember, like, reading parts. I have only read parts of it, and they're just, like, insane, just ridiculous.
Well, you need to speak five languages at the very minimum to kind of get a grasp of something. But, it, like, you know, I think you'd be punished. It would be sort of masochistic to want to adapt Ulysses. But I think it's sort of possible. But, I mean, how do you... You know, you say a picture paints a thousand words, but, I mean, how do you visualize for instance, the chapter where he goes to lunch and the entire chapter is written in food puns, essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, no, how do you do that?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and that's beyond, you know, being writing about writing. That's just writing where instead of being about, like, the subject, it's really about, or the substance.
Yeah, it's about the style, form over content. It's stylistic. Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, you know, unless... even though it is, you can try to adapt the style, you'd kind of have to have a director who either could go, well, I've got exactly how to film, like, use a camera in the way to completely emulate the literal stylings of James Joyce, or you could, you know, just kind of have someone who pushes it in a different way.
But there's also the chapter, I've forgotten all the chapter names, but towards the end they visit the brothel, and of course it's a play, but it's a play that you physically cannot stage because it's just a whole lot of bizarre. But, you know, I can imagine just someone like, you know, Lynch, or I always just mention Lynch
when they go, like, I need a crazy dude. Like, yeah, Lynch.
Doing this unstageable play, which is actually kind of quite filmable. And it's all visual because it is done in stage directions that are... At the time...
Yeah, but being Lynch, like, he'd kind of get to the set and then just kind of point a camera somewhere else and go, yeah, we'll do that. That's great.
Yeah, all right. Well, someone who's sort of surreal and a perfectionist. Maybe Kubrick could have done it back in the day.
Well, he's dead, but...
Oh, yeah. Kubrick's dead too. Actually, but then he'd just change and make it all an allegory for Native American genocide.
Yeah. So...
But speaking of Kubrick... Lolita.
Yes, we do. Oh, well, we've got a lot of stuff to cover.
Well, Lolita, we can...
The main ones being 2001... And Lolita.
And The Shining. Let's start with Lolita because it ties in with kind of Ulysses and Atonement in terms of very textual.
Yes, and of course being that classic example of an untrustworthy narrator.
Well, I'd
and
say
that being so much of what the book is.
I'd say Lolita is the be all and end all of unreliable narrators.
And that's
never been done better.
And that's the thing, because it is that first person narrative in however you want to look at it. It is the first person narrative. And a film being what it is that you get just, you know, completely, you get this kind of omnipotent kind of like viewpoint of this can be anything. So that's why you need somebody like Kubrick to be able to adapt Lolita, and we will mention why only Kubrick can adapt Lolita.
But he doesn't adapt. I mean, the thing about Lolita is it's not just an unreliable narrator who stylizes events to... I mean, that's the brilliance of it. It's like he completely covers over things, and he just obtrusive at parts and just... on covering up his misdeeds, but without outright lying to the audience, to the reader, which is what's clever. But anyway,
I love in for more reasons than one that the tagline for Kubrick's Lolita was, "How did they ever make a movie of Lolita?" Because I mean, obviously, like, there's the immediate kind of content and the potential sensitivity there, but there's also the fact that there is that unreliable narrator.
You haven't seen it.
I haven't seen it. I won't, but I have seen Adrian Lynn's.
Adrian Lynn's.
And if I wasn't laughing so much, I would have been really pissed off.
Well, it's just sad, essentially, because it's done as a romantic tragedy.
Yeah, and that's the thing, because I've never seen a film be more retarded in being faithful to a book.
And you haven't even seen it.
No, I've seen Lynn's. I've seen Lynn's Lolita.
Oh, you have seen Lynn's? Oh,
yeah. Yeah, it's fucking terrible.
Oh, right, I know.
Yeah, no. And they get an 18-year-old to play Lolita. Ridiculous.
Yeah, but...
But...
It's just such an outright fumbling of the... Because, you know, the Humbert as a character, what's so strong about him is essentially that he's evil.
Yeah.
He's a kind of testament of this use of...
Educated.
Of wordiness and...
And that, like, that...
And a pretentious...
That reeling you in, and that's kind of what makes Lolita what it is. Unreliable narrator, this reprehensible beast... Just also being this noble, educated wordsmith.
It's kind of like a tribute you know, as sort of language as a tool of seduction in a way, I think, because it's like seducing the reader.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then with the fucking movie, they just play it straight.
I love so much. One thing I just like, when it opens with him, like, at the end, like, having...
shot Quilty?
Yeah. And his, like, the opening, like, love of my life, light of my loins. Just like that while he's looking at the blood on his hands. And you're just like, oh my God, you know what you're in for? And you're just like, oh shit.
I know. And there was
it is fucking hilarious.
There's a great... I was reading when it came out, you know, there's a controversy because Lolita has to be controversial, apparently. Someone went, why is there a controversy? They are both destroyed by their relationship and it's tragic. And this is, I was like, no, that's not the point of, oh, I give up. You know, actually, I was just thinking, because, you know, of how do you deliver those lines well? And I was just thinking, you know who I reckon would make a great Humbert?
Who?
Bill Shatner. Think about it. Or
I thought you were about to say Bill Murray for a second there. I was like, I can kind of
No, it has to have someone, it has to be someone with a lot of, like, fake gravitas. And I reckon Shatner's got that Lolita light of...
Oh, God.
You know.
Shit.
She was low in the morning... on the tip of the tongue.
Or Leonard Nimoy.
Yeah. Or Patrick Stewart, for that matter, because he's good at taking the piss out of himself. The like Star Trek Lolita.
We're going for older dudes, though. How old is Humbert?
Old.
Is that old?
I think he's 50-something.
Okay.
You could be... I think he's just got to be, like, oldish while being sort of believable that he's a viable sexual...
offender.
Well.
Yeah.
I mean, she... But, anyway, so...
he's a sexual offender.
Coming in 2014, Lolita in Space.
Oh, fuck.
We're going to write it.
Yeah, as a noir, as a neo-noir. As we have learned, if you want to, from the Director's Odyssey, if you want to start a career, you start with a neo-noir, kids.
We should, like, pitch this to maybe on a message of development. It's Lolita in Space, but it's a noir.
I bet there are executives stupid enough to say yes.
Well,
as long as you get a name on it. Anyway, we're getting sidetracked.
Well, the Kubrick one.
So back, yes, I'm still on Kubrick.
So you haven't seen the Kubrick one.
No, I haven't seen the Kubrick one. I have seen the Lynn.
Worth watching. Your priorities are out of whack, my friend. Yeah, the Kubrick one, essentially, how did they make a movie out of Lolita? They didn't, is the answer to that question. Nabokov did write it, but what happened was Peter Sellers got his foot in the door and then it turned into a wacky cat and mouse game, you know, as they run across the country in pursuit by Peter Sellers in various wacky disguises. But it is
good. How do they handle what's her name, Lolita's mother, how do they handle that, her death?
I think they do
her
it
accidental death.
Well, because
that for me is the ultimate kind of moment where you first go, all right, what's with the unreliable narrator.
Yeah,
that's kind of a really
pivotal
moment.
It's been a
long
time, but if I recall directly, because it's done as a black comedy, essentially. So I think, and to their credit, James Mason is lecherous in it. Like he's actually, even though it's the structure of the story and the content of the film is so different to the book, James Mason is Humbert. He's like whatever the film was around him. He's read the book almost and kind of. Got that down.
Yeah, really embodied that.
And
yeah.
If I remember, I think it just happens. I don't necessarily show it and sort of play it as just a dark comic moment.
Oh, cool.
I think,
but like, is she like? Oh, well, I mean, let's not really.
I can't remember.
But okay. Well,
but
anyway,
it's really. It's worth watching.
I will. So anyway, while on the Kubrick train, let's move on to 2001 or Shining.
I go 2001.
Okay, cool. So, I mean, this is a very interesting one because it's also worth noting that who did you write about?
Arthur C. Clarke
and Kubrick decided that they wanted to work together, and together, note, not Arthur C. Clarke write something and then Kubrick
adapt
it. They decided that they met up and they got on famously and they really just enjoyed the same stuff and just thought, we have to work together. So they started working towards what essentially became 2001, but they ended up writing the book and writing the screenplay simultaneously. And what's interesting to note is that it appears screenplay by Stanley Kubrick and Arthur C. Clarke, but the book is solely credited to Arthur C. Clarke. And there are some significant differences in it, like the...
Have you read the book?
No.
See, my understanding was that actually the book explains a lot more.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's inherently because, you know, Kubrick isn't scared of silence, and God bless him for that. So,
well, that's not inherent.
But I see one thing that just works so well, and it's just about one of the most incredible sequences, like with no humans involved, and it's such a long sequence. Is the early Earth sequence?
Yeah,
with the gorillas and everything. And I'm just like, how would you write that? Having not read the book, is it?
You'd do it in stream of conscious monotonous prose in five languages. That's what you'd do it in.
Well, just that sequence is just so amazing, and that it just made me curious, knowing that it was a book as well. Because I'm like, how would this have worked in the book? And when he's going through the light, when he's going through the light at the end.
Oh yeah, that.
That's, you know, it's incredible visual sequences and just moments that are so visual and so cinematic, like the cut between the bone and the space station moving between the prehistoric time and the modern, well, not modern, future time. And there's just...
What do you mean Pan Am? Don't run the space. Well, no, it's past now.
Oh yeah. Right. There you go. But he was obviously a little bit more hopeful about, you know.
Well, my favorite, the classic is from all those future films, they all thought we'd have video phones in the future. Mm. And of course we did get video phones, then, you know, society quickly realized we don't really want to do hair and makeup every time we make a call. So no one fucking uses them. Yeah. That's just a great little piece of, you know, a great just observation like, about.
Yeah, you got it wrong, visionary directors from the 60s and 70s and 80s. Fuck you. But yeah. So 2001 is an interesting one, just for the fact that they were developed alongside each other, which does happen now a fair bit as well. Like, say, The Social Network, Aaron Sorkin read the 15-page book proposal, which Sony had the rights for, and said, does anyone want to do this? It'll be an adapted screenplay. And he actually wrote it with his own researcher and, like, had barely any, like, side-by-side content with the actual book. It was just that the rights to the story were owned by the book, which was then owned for film rights by Sony, which is quite funny, really.
Yeah, I mean, and I think you're just getting into a much more sort of, like, arbitrary and silly point when it's a non-fiction. But no, the whole developing alongside is interesting.
Mm, yeah.
But what is also is Arthur C. Clarke went on and wrote two sequels, I believe.
Yes, that's right, yeah.
Or maybe even three.
2001, I think, then it went 2010.
The year we make contact or something, and then it's like 2030, where everyone is just ascended to a higher... I haven't seen it. I'm just assuming. Yeah. I don't know.
Again, probably another really hopeful... just another hopeful projection for humankind. Probably not going to get there. Yeah. But moving on from 2001, Shining.
Yeah.
And this is kind of moving to Stephen King territory.
Stephen King is interesting.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I think Stephen King's a good writer. He's a genre writer and he's an airport writer, but he's probably the best of that bunch. And The Shining is his best book. Unfortunately, it happened to be made into a better film for him. And Stephen King famously disliked Kubrick's interpretation.
Not the only writer to dislike Kubrick's interpretation. We will get to that.
And weirdly enough, even though I think The Shining is one of the greatest films ever made, and I don't think The Shining, the book, is one of the greatest books ever written, even though it is a really good book and it's worth reading. But I think The Shining is the greater accomplishment in its respective field.
Yeah.
I think King has legitimate issues because it was a really personal story and it's essentially about alcoholism and, you know, domestic violence.
Mm. And Kubrick made it a more heady kind
Kubrick made it into this sort of layered enigma that could be about I mean, there's this documentary coming out, and I think we, you know, we'll kind of do one on The Shining. It's called Room 243, I believe. Whatever the fucking room is, I always forget because it's different in the film and the book, which is another, like, why was that? And so it's a film that just suggests so much without... It's similar to Space Odyssey in that way, suggests so much without answering a lot. You know, and there's kind of, I suppose... I mean, my guess of what he's trying to say is just... It's a meditation on... White man's
animalistic, primal, you know, violent.
No, because there's all those, there's all that American Indian subtext.
Oh yeah,
yeah. I mean, we really need a full hour to talk about The Shining.
Yeah, no.
But what he did make, for instance, he cast Jack Nicholson, which immediately meant that he is predisposed. It's not a good man turning bad; it's a bad man becoming bad, and that's a big difference from the book. And another thing is, there's less confirmed... Well, I mean, there is really, because when he's taken out of the pantry, that's supernatural. But the supernatural in it is slightly more implied than explicit, which King had a problem with, because this, in his eyes, made Jack Torrance, the main character, less sympathetic. Anywho... but Stephen King, and so that's one. The other is Carrie, which I happen to think is one of the greatest. Well, look, it's definitely
the only good Brian De Palma film.
Yeah, it's definitely in my top underrated list.
Yeah,
even though it's a quite well respected film,
probably doesn't need to be remade with Chloe Moretz.
Yeah, I mean the remake, and this is anyway. What this ties into is the book's not that good. Stephen King doesn't think it's that good. It's his first novel. It's very undercooked. It's padded out with these newspaper articles, so it's got that sort of, I don't know, like the literary equivalent of the Blair Witch Project. And it's just turned into this really, I don't know, the film, it's hard to describe. It's sort of starts out very claustrophobic and bleak, and then mixed in with a very, very banal standard high school drama, and then elevates into this high-octane nightmare, horrific Bernard Herrmann sampling. you know, long, nightmarish sequence, which is just... It's one of the most horrific films ever made, in my opinion. And it's much better than the book. Anyway, now they've decided... Yeah. To make a remake of it, and the reasoning is, we're gonna go close to the novel, but no one wants that. Stephen King doesn't want that. Yeah, yeah. He's publicly come out against it. There's no frickin' point.
They're just realizing, like, you know, oh, we can make films out of these Stephen King things. Apparently, you know, The Shining, that was pretty good. Yeah, just chuck this into remake. Yeah, just get Chloe Moretz. Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, let's just totally do it. Yeah,
I mean, the Stephen come King, on. Not oh, God, like. There's so many famous ones. Yeah, I mean, so you got Misery, Shining, Carrie, Stand By Me.
Oh, yeah, that's
right. Shawshank Redemption, Green Mile.
Frank Darabont likes
Misery,
them, so yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Yeah. So that's... Yeah, no, they do like to remake Stephen King. But just quickly while we're still on the King thing and that how that linked to Kubrick, and also just on Kubrick, somebody being really unhappy with Kubrick's adaptation is absolutely has to be mentioned, is A Clockwork Orange. Now, for me, I fucking love the book and I fucking love the movie. And it's funny because basically the point of contention between Burgess and Kubrick, I think it's actually interesting to note just kind of the main difference between the book and... the film is that first person kind of perspective of Alex, and it is a very subjective kind of experience of Alex's world in the film, but like you've got this like first person stream of conscious monologue just with this completely befuddling text, which, you know, is mixed between English, Russian and nonsense, and it's just so exciting to read. And of course you've got the ultra violence of it all, my brothers, the ultra violence, and it's written so peculiarly. And then of course you've got the element of when they burst into this guy's house and like beat and rape him and his wife, not him. And he's writing a novel, and it's called Clockwork Orange by Anthony Burgess. And, and you know, apparently something similar happened to Burgess, and that's what...
It did happen to Burgess, and that's
what
how
the inspiration that, yeah. for the novel, that's where it came from. But it's just so interesting, just like... And this is one of the things I just love about just adaptation, and just film in general, is that scene, they're shooting it, and then Kubrick says to Malcolm McDowell, you know, we need some ultraviolence here. And Malcolm McDowell, just in the middle of this take, while just like beating the woman and kicking the man, just starts singing in the Rain. And it's just this, oh, it's this sickening sequence, which you could not write. And he just made it up on the spot. And as soon as they finish shooting it, like Kubrick just grabs him and takes him out. Like, they're just in the middle of shooting. He just grabs him and just takes him out of the studio, and they just go. And he gets him into his office, and he gets on the phone, and he buys the rights to that song there and then, just because it happened on set. And you like that. And that's one of the things I do think is important about Kubrick, particularly with his adaptations, is that he followed his nose completely about what would work visually. And I think to a big degree, you need to do that in adapting. And, I mean, depending on the story, like, some lend themselves visually, some don't. And with something like that, that is so distinguished and really particular with just the getting inside the character's head, being put inside the character's head, with film you kind of need some other way of just understanding how they are and what they are. And there's no way that he can like be just kind of walking around saying a monologue as he's kicking these. So, I mean, the kicking and everything is so much a part of it. But one thing that really conveyed is of the Droogs is the joy that they get out of, you know, destroying anything and everything. And that basically is the point of the book. Well, not the point of the book. The point of the book is kind of the condition and, you know, conditioning and, you know, kind of repressing the madman within you, which isn't, which is the point of the film, but it wasn't actually the point of the book when initially written.
Yeah.
Because they deleted the publisher removed the last chapter, and Kubrick used that print of the book.
Yeah,
as the basis.
But Burgess
film.
In general doesn't really like that book.
Yeah,
but
he's a bit of a salt.
An important thing about that, you know, when Kubrick adapts a book, he kind of does his own thing.
He does
and
his
that's
own thing.
Fine, absolutely. But what's different about that and something like Atonement or the 97 Lolita is that they don't clearly stand apart. I watch those and I go, you're trying and you're failing. Whereas when you watch a Kubrick adaptation, it's like you clearly just have gone,
well, yeah, exactly.
done something different.
Well, it's because he is a cinematic master. That's a fact of the matter.
But,
so he knows what will work and what won't. And if there's something textual that works textually, and you can acknowledge that and move on from it, you have to be able to follow something that will work.
Yeah,
in the cinematic medium,
but it's a large part of it is just you know, liberties with the text are absolutely fine.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if something misses the point of the book, but is a great film in its own right, I don't have a problem with it in itself. But if the film is still trying to be an adaptation, like Atonement and Lolita, yet misses the point, then it has failed, no matter what else is working, I find.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a debate about the legitimacy of a failed adaptation as a good film in its own right. Whereas I don't think, you know, any of Kubrick's films, no matter how different they are failed adaptations.
Yeah.
And obviously they're good films. So.
It's interesting kind of like talking just about the divergence about something that makes it cinematically viable, and just considering and this will just be quite a quick point, but just writers, like authors who adapted their own screenplays, and something quite recently like The Perks of Being a Wallflower that recently came out, and so much of it, like the point of it is that you've got this kid writing letters to some anonymous some anonymous end, and I've read part of the book, and it's just this him. It's just this just epistolary, just kind of development over time of him just talking to no one, but you know, just by through positioning is supposed to be the reader, and basically, I just couldn't really understand how that would work on film, but he happens to be quite an adept director who bookends it with like one introductory passage from the novel and the outro with this pretty incredible sequence, which I fucking hated, but that's for personal reasons, just because they used Heroes by David Bowie like it was, you can't do that with Heroes, Steve. Sorry. But anyway, just on that note of just, writers making their own films, is really interesting to just actually see a director who took apart his own work.
Yeah.
And just kind of being willing to do that. And it is good to see. So I really enjoyed that.
But I mean, in the screenplay, Nabokov did that with Lolita. I mean, that's a classic example. But absolutely, I think why he didn't have a problem with that, I think what Nabokov probably would have said, do what you want. Humbert has to stay the villain. Nabokov would have not liked the 97 one.
No, he wouldn't have. But then, just in that similar vein, there's Rosengill, for which Tom Stoppard won an Oscar. Worth note, he won an Oscar for, I'm not sure if it was for writer or director, but he won an Oscar for it, which is in.
You sure you don't think of his Oscar for Shakespeare in Love?
Yeah, no, I'm sure.
By the way, did Coppola do Finnegan's Wake?
No.
Yeah, that was completely. No one has tried to do Finnegan's Wake.
I swear to God, I saw it in the video store in his section, though. It might have been a TV movie, but I couldn't.
No, he didn't. Look, academics are still. There's no consensus on what the book is about, for God's sake.
Oh, right, no, that was for Shakespeare in Love, bugger. Whoops. Anyway.
So Christian's...
Yeah, I'm just kind of... Yeah, just kind of just getting a couple of things wrong. Sorry. Fine.
Yeah. But the Stoppard one is an example of...
Is another one. And also, just another personal one, which I really like, which we were maybe going to do for... Not for classic, but for good film, was 25th Hour, which is written by David Benioff, and I read the book, and I like it, he also wrote the screenplay, and then Spike Lee got his hands on it and just made it his own thing. And of course, added a number of things like breaking the line and really, really rapid editing and insane, just great, great flights of fancy.
Yeah.
Fucking love that movie. And also the post 9/11 element, which just adds some kind of impending sense of utter doom to the whole.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. But, I think.
I suppose if we're talking about adaptations, we got to broach the recent phenomenon of
franchise.
That's
also being written alongside theme as well. Because, they're starting to be made before there's even any conclusion. They don't know what to foreshadow.
I know.
They have no idea where it's
heading. Which is how the Harry Potter series completely fell apart. But, we should go back to the beginning, which kind of kicked off.
Which is the first kind of...
Well, I'd say Bond would be.
I suppose, yeah, absolutely.
I mean, Bond, it's funny because the story about, those two was Ian Fleming, who is just a complete... He's essentially James Bond without the kicking ass, so he's a misogynist alcoholic.
That's the classic delusions of grandeur of a misogynist alcoholic. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to write a novel about a guy who's essentially me, but does stuff.
Well, that's not true. He was a spy in World War II and did that kind of stuff. He just didn't do it when he was writing it, is what I meant. And he did it with Roald Dahl, funnily enough. Yes.
Wow.
Anyway, so they got it and they did it out of order and they made it way more sensationalist and over the top, even though Ian Fleming's ones are pretty over the top.
And it's interesting because it did kind of go through that development just towards being complete parody of itself constantly as well. And I mean, I'm not sure because of course the original Casino Royale was that. With George Lazenby, I think.
No.
Who was the original Bond?
Well, I mean, you've got the American one, which was a TV movie, and then you've got the '67, which is actually a parody with David Niven and Woody Allen.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
David Niven's in the. Hang on.
Wait, no. It's Peter. Peter Sellers.
Yeah, Peter Sellers is in one, but just Casino Royale.
Oh, David Niven. Yeah.
Right. I mean.
And Orson Welles as Le Chiffre.
Yeah, I mean, beautiful. Look, I just like to say that really the James Bond films start with Dr. No.
Yeah.
And what one of the funniest things is, this is just an anecdote I find really interesting about that whole adaptational process. Okay, so James Bond is the perfect English specimen, and this is how he's written. And they cast Sean Connery, who's a Scottish bodybuilder.
Scottish, yeah.
So Sean Connery is cast, and Ian Fleming is not amused at all. and anyway, he just, you know, you can't cast that. I forget
you
how
can't
he described
cast that filthy that Scottish.
Scottish. Anyway, he saw, and what the producer says, what, here, you don't look comfortable in a tuxedo. I want you to take this tuxedo and I want you to sleep in it. Because, you know, this is just a crazy time. Anyway, Ian Fleming saw this, saw Connery, loved it. He loved Connery's portrayal of it. Then, because he was still writing the books, I mean, there's about 10 of them or something and a few short stories. It's, and they're not really a series, so to speak. They're just a bunch of stories. He writes in Scottish ancestry into the book. Oh, now, wait. Yeah. I know. He writes in Scottish ancestry into the books. And, of course, they never really pick up on this in the films until this year in Skyfall, where they canonize an element from the books in the film series, which started because of the film series.
That's so cool.
Yes, which is this kind of an interesting cycle about the relationship
and of course
between
this...
an adapted franchise and the original franchise itself.
And of course, Skyfall being one of the first modern, like since say Casino Royale, where they, which is really kind of being making reference to the old Bond, like when he gets the Aston Martin out and everything, is these really lovely dips of the hat and everything. So that's lovely.
Although
it's bit British in a way. Like, you wouldn't see that in an American film franchise. But, I mean...
Well, you know, he'd be Canadian.
Canadian.
Jimmy Bond isn't a Canadian.
Yeah, no. But that is fun. I like... Thank you. You've brightened my day. That's lovely.
That's it. Yeah. And also, I think the Casino Royale, the 2006 one, everyone said that's so good. You know, why is it? Because it's Daniel Craig. Is because it's got a good director. Is because it's, you know, gritty and more down to earth. And I
changed the tone entirely.
That is true. But also, it's based on a really solid book with a well done story, which they hadn't had in a while. So, you know, it is a really good book. And if you read one James Bond book, that is the one, because they're pretty hit and miss otherwise.
Yeah. The Broccoli's made a good call.
Indeed. But apparently they've sworn off remaking any more. Yeah, which is in a way a certain amount of integrity, I suppose.
Yeah, but I suppose. Fair enough. Good but yeah, anyway, so yeah, moving from...
Well, I think Lord of the Rings...
Yes, is next. I mean, you know, we will kind of get to the Twilights and the Harry Potters and the Hunger Games, but with a bit less because, you know...
Well...
I don't know. They were less... They're more acknowledged to be for the teen market and they're not really respected as films so much as Lord of the Rings.
Except
is
maybe
with the
Alfonso's.
Hundreds of Oscars. That's not really a... Oh, yeah, I suppose, yeah. Alfonso's is beautifully done.
Yeah,
but,
I mean, I think... Like, I quite like Lord of the Rings films. I think they're well done.
I don't really... I just don't like Peter Jackson as a filmmaker. And, you know, people who try to say, oh, he's a modern, brilliant filmmaker. He doesn't put a step wrong. Lovely bones, people. Shut up. Okay?
Yeah.
He can have bad judgment. And to me, Lord of the Rings is not as bad as The Lovely Bones. But it's just... So the slow motion in that film, they would have been normal length films if not for the fucking slow motion.
I know.
I get so pissed off. You know, Scorsese, you know, he can slow motion with some like opera thing playing over like some, you know, moment of brutality. Like that's cool. He started that. Everyone, it's become,
would have made the battle of Helm's Deep so much,
oh,
you know.
Yeah,
yeah,
you know, just like charge. Like slow motion. Yeah. That would have been just a bit nicer. Well, to a degree, he kind of does, but just that, the montage kind of idea of a lot of the wars and everything is just so overdone and so insipid and just to me just so tepid. I don't know.
I mean, it's a film series I'm not passionate about, and many are.
I did watch it at the time and go, "This is the best thing I've ever seen in my life." But I was 12, so I reserved.
Yeah,
I was
the same, and you know, since I've kind of grown, and I think it's because that particular brand of fantasy, that English, you know, elves and dragons, etc., I find slightly unimaginative inherently. But
I think also the fact
I think that's as good as that genre is going to get.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
I think
that's
and
true.
I think in terms of epic journey cinema and kind of the
And Gollum was an incredible achievement.
Yeah, and I think if you're going to, like, you know, that genre and so many of those journey tropes, if you're going to hold them up, Lord of the Rings is a great entry point and just a great stand bearer for that.
Yeah, just as a filmmaker, he's far too manipulative. And, you know, even, the one, Kate Winslet and Melanie Lynskey on Beautiful Creatures, I think it's called, I fucking hated that as well. I haven't seen a film of his that I like. And I mean, I haven't seen The Hobbit, but I don't think I'm going to. That's just milking the cash cow.
That's a good example, because I think Lord of the Rings' impact was like, you know,
it was massive. Like,
adaptation meant abridgment. You know, they were synonymous with each other. Yeah. And then Lord of the Rings, even though he cuts out quite a bit,
he does,
because they're such long books.
He really just gives it.
He gives so much of it. Yeah. And New Line said, yeah, do three films, whatever.
Like, I mean, you know, it's like, and it had a happy ending. Frodo, he put the ring in the fire. It took him 9 fucking hours, but he did it.
I know.
It's a happy ending.
But that increases, isn't the journey really? It's about the journey.
Oh, the journey's the destination, mate. Yeah, great. Good on him.
But
yeah. Oh, one of my favourite details from The Lord of the Rings is when Viggo Mortensen, he kicks the head of there's the head of this Uruk-hai on a sword, and he kicks it off, and he just kept Peter Jackson kept trying to get him to scream louder, just like, I'm so frustrated, and like there's this one take where he kicks it off, and he just he just let out this massive scream and just like falls to his knees. And people's like, great. And then like Viggo Mortensen gets up and kind of just walks around. Like 10 minutes later, like, whoa, what's up with Viggo? He's like, oh, I think I broke my toe.
Broke
his toe. It's beautiful. He's just like, good on you.
What this starts is a trend, and you see that influence the Harry Potter series and of the kind of the homework necessary adaptation.
Yeah.
Which I think is just poisonous.
There are so many details that you cannot understand if you haven't read the books.
It's the milking of the cash cow, because what it essentially says is there are enough fans. Lord of the Rings suggests, even though it's not quite true, there are enough fans of Lord of the Rings for that to be the market, and Harry Potter steps it further.
Mm.
And then it's taken into Twilight, where the only people who see like Breaking Dawn are the people who've read Breaking Dawn, and that's enough.
Yeah. Or people being dragged there by their girlfriends.
Yeah, I mean, there's that as well, but it's such a widely read book, and this essentially means there's no actual craft of adaptation.
Oh, none at all.
It's
frustrating.
And
I think it's exactly the same for The Hunger Games. And I saw The Hunger Games. I mean, if you think about it, yeah, sure, it's probably just as like, as simple and, you know, artless a book as Twilight or Harry Potter. They're simple, they're like teen fiction, but when you think about the idea...
Let's separate Harry Potter and Hunger Games from Twilight.
Okay.
They are confident children's fiction.
Okay. But just the idea of just, you know, just in the age of reality TV and kind of just tapping into something like, you know, when you hear about like the Colosseum or these gladiatorial games that from times gone by, and you think, oh, that's ridiculous. How could anybody ever watch that? That's ridiculous. You know, like, I was about to say, you know, 500 years from now, people look back and ask, how could they ever watch Jersey Shore? No, people are already saying that now. So, you know, there's like kind of correlations between the two. I mean, there is a little bit more kind of animalistic urge in the human condition, seeing people get beheaded for fun. But just the kind of correlations between the two kind of put into the Hunger Games world. That's an interesting idea. And I think if you'd got a good director, in the same way that like Harry Potter or Children of Men took Alfonso Cuarón to direct their film from like, and I mean I've read Prisoner of Azkaban and I've read Children of Men, and I don't think they're particularly outstanding books, but Alfonso Cuarón is a master and he made them great. I think they could have equally done something similar with The Hunger Games and made something, you know, just interesting and. I mean, they had what was their budget? It was something like $80 million. And they made $300 million in their first weekend. That film was always going to make their
money.
Exactly. They could have taken a risk and done something really cool, like got a Cuarón or a Gilliam or somebody like that to do The Hunger Games.
But it's so much easier doing what they're doing. That's what's so sad about it.
And it's disappointing because Gary Ross, who ended up directing it, directed Pleasantville. And have you seen Pleasantville?
No.
It's about a coloured girl in a conservative American town, and she's like the entire town is in black and white, and she's in color, and it's actually a like really enjoyable film. And he just fucking just Hunger Games sucks so much. It's just that really just film illiterate kind of just chuck a camera and some money in a room
and with some
Lenny stars.
Kravitz in it as well?
Lenny Kravitz is in it. He's like he's fine. Like,
why
whatever.
Is Lenny Kravitz in?
There are just some really infuriating moments. Just really infuriating. Just like the you can't actually understand like why he's being
but
such a.
I mean, I can't talk too much about the Twilight films because I haven't seen them. I'm not going to see
I'm
them. Not
we
read
don't
them.
Need to talk about
but,
them. We
I
just
mean,
reference them as.
But the Harry Potter ones,
they're interesting. Yeah.
Well, I mean, because you know, we've read all the Harry Potter books, and they're fine for what they are.
Mm. And just for the sole reason that they did understand, just the hiring of Alfonso Cuarón just is. A really, really, really ballsy kind of move. And I think it must have come out of the fact that, of course, the first preference for the first director
was Gilliam,
and that was J.K. Rowling's
and
preference.
And Rowling, actually, to her credit, really stopped Harry Potter from becoming a disaster
yeah.
of a series
yeah,
because
yeah.
she said, you know, for one thing, this has to be a British production. Yeah.
But they got
an
American director, Chris Columbus, to do the first two films.
Well, I know, and it's rubbish.
Terrible.
But
fucking abysmal.
But it could have been worse because,
yeah,
you know,
yes,
it has
of course.
A pretty decent cast.
Mm.
But the problem is, and it's a problem with Azkaban that I didn't even read, and it's actually a problem that one has, that the Columbus ones unfortunately don't, and
which
it's
is...
the Marauders. It's the fact that there's a plot hole there that we didn't pick up on, and so many people didn't pick up on.
Because they read the book.
Because they read the book. But, you should have included that in the film. And as the Harry Potter series go on, and because
well, let's just mention what that was that they should have included. They should have mentioned the fact that, like, it was never stipulated who the Marauders were.
Yeah,
they never made mention of that. And think about it, they never did.
And
but it's just accepted.
It
like,
just
that
gets
it's part of it.
More absurd as the series goes because Half Blood Prince, of course, the title is Half Blood Prince, which is
but it's never ever ever mentioned.
I think it is. It's just such a small part of. Oh, maybe it's not.
I don't think it is.
I think it's the same. I can't.
I've only.
Seen it once. The book is in the film that. The potions book, the Half Blood Prince, but Snape doesn't reveal it.
He doesn't reveal that he is the Half Blood Prince.
Yeah,
so it's
like
it's
his mother's
it?
Prince or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, but then it gets more absurd because J.K. Rowling is just a Chekhov's gun obsessive, and she's put all these through the films, like the locket in the house in the fifth book, I think, and that's not in the book. And then, it's not in the film. So when it happens in the seventh, it's just what. And frankly, by the time they get to the sixth and seventh films, they make no fucking sense on their own. And I mean, it's just it goes downhill. Even though
I think the main one which would have made no sense is what was it the what's it called when Harry like gets someone's memory and puts it in the little basin?
Oh, the Pensieve.
The Pensieve, yeah. Those sequences were like. Chapters on chapters in the book.
Yeah.
And that starts at about the fourth one, which is the first Pensieve.
Yeah.
And they're chapters upon chapters. And they're like 5-second sequences in the film. And you're just like, no, like that's retarded. It's just,
it's so problematic. And it was so sad. Also, critics, I noticed, just not really picking up on this. And I think it was Margaret and David.
Margaret and David
who
really just went, what is going
for
on?
It. Yeah, who just said, this doesn't make sense if you haven't read the books. And I'm like, well, it doesn't. And that's a massive flaw in the film that if you don't address, you're fucked up. And also what Deathly Hallows did, which is... And I actually didn't have a problem with within those two because I thought the first Deathly Hallows, and I'm kind of alone here, I thought was the best the series had been since Azkaban.
Yeah.
Because it was just this quite poignant road movie.
I love the moment when Harry and Hermione
and they
start playing
Nick
Cave. And
I know.
Like, where the fuck did that come from?
I know. So they,
it was
so they
beautiful.
Completely decompressed.
So, you know, you spend $200 million and the best moment is two people dancing in a tent. Like,
but it is really...
It's just because of the relief of it. You're just like, where the... Oh,
yeah.
Awesome.
And it's sincere.
Yeah, yeah.
And also,
yeah.
I think, you know, they decompress the story.
Yeah. I would have liked to have seen, imagine this, one, like, a handheld camera shot in Harry Potter. That would just That would rule. Anyway.
Anyway, so Deathly Hallows is the shortest book since Azkaban. Mm. And then they've split the final book into two, because Deathly Hallows, I think, is actually a really crap book because so much happened in such a short amount of time and et cetera.
Ooh, yeah, like she could only make it so long.
Yeah, but I mean, but fifth, she should have done, the longest, yeah, done anyway. More, less navel-gazing in the previous books. Anyway, maybe not introduce three more fucking magical artifacts that they have to collect. It's like a video game at this stage. Anyway, but the first Deathly Hallows, they kind of go, we got time, let's chill out. You know, let's have impressionistic animated sequences. Let's have dancing in Nick Cave. Let's just go fucking nuts. Let's have them walk around London.
Mm.
And I just thought that it was by far the most interesting film since Prisoner of Azkaban.
And also like, a slightly ballsy just by... Yeah. And you can see, like, with that, like thing being written alongside something else, you know, being the book being written alongside the film, is that, you know, when she was writing the seventh book, she would have had in mind, like, this is going to
Daniel
become
Radcliffe
a film.
But
the funniest thing, the funniest thing for me is, like, there's that entire sequence where they have to go into the ministry. So she's writing this entire, like, 40, 50-page sequence where there are other people. And I mean, they'd done the Polyjuice Potion thing in the past.
Yeah.
But it was turning into Crabbe and Goyle, who are established characters, or other people turning into Harry. So, like, more Daniel Radcliffe, sweet, chug it in there. Mm. But these... what? Who do they get? The guy who plays Harry is the guy from The Departed. He's... You know the guy I'm talking about, the guy the Irish guy in The Departed.
The Irish guy in The Departed.
Okay, yeah,
are
shut
you
up.
Fucking serious?
Okay, yeah. But I just noticed that and I was just like, damn, that's hilarious. But the point is that they had to, in a, like, major studio film, she gave them no choice but to put in front of a screen a no-name actor for like 10, 15 minutes.
Yeah, I
and
know.
I was just like, I was reading that and going, you legend. That is awesome. Like, that is so cool.
But now what's happened is that Breaking Dawn, obviously.
Oh god.
It was two parts. I don't know if it needed to be, but
I'm sure they could have done it.
And they're doing it the same with the Hunger Games. So now
and Hobbit.
Oh, but The Hobbit is a disaster.
Well, see, the funny thing about that is, like, people say, oh, it's the smallest book, but the thing is they've actually included a lot from the Silmarillion.
No, they haven't.
Have they? Oh, no.
Well, see, that's what people think, but they don't have the rights to the Silmarillion, so they're stuffing in stuff from the Lord of the Rings appendices.
Oh, Christ.
Which was already, it's such a ill-conceived idea to turn a book that is shorter than a single Lord of the Rings film into a trilogy of three-hour films. Yeah. I mean, that is such a dumb idea.
It's
conceptually broken. There is no way, I'm saying this now, there is no way he can pull that off. Come Hobbit Part 3, An Unexpected Journey.
Mm. Yeah.
So, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's... Well, that's the franchise is well and truly covered. So I think...
Oh,
that...
actually, what I want to mention, and this is a nice little connecting of dots, is that my favourite of those young adult... books around the time was Lemony Snicket's series of Unfortunate Events.
Ah, yes.
Which were the postmodern, very textual kids' books.
Yeah,
and of course, when they tried to adapt, even though they were really popular books, when they tried to do the film, it just didn't translate.
Well, they did also get Jim Carrey and Billy Connolly, which was
that's not the problem.
But
he's not particularly bad in that role. And Billy Connolly is fine for that role. You just... They're, to a certain extent, they're completely unadaptable.
Oh, yeah.
It's just funny that these.
And again,
kind of,
like it's like writers tropes in a way.
Exactly,
yeah.
It is. I mean, if, you know, they're very very idiosyncratic
literary
books, and it's all about the narrator, the narrator's personality, who then actually becomes a character.
Yeah, yeah.
With this complex mythology. And I just think it's hilarious that essentially the producers of this big budget kids blockbuster, and critically actually it wasn't too badly received, I think the art direction is in the right direction.
Nice.
But yeah, it's just funny that they actually come across the same problems you'd get when adapting Lolita. I've always thought though that. And another example, of course, is the kind of very half-baked Narnia film series.
Oh, cry! Don't.
Who cares?
Why?
But anyway.
No. Just quickly as well.
Hang on. Tied to that in Series of Unfortunate Events is if you ever saw, they did a BBC, I think it was BBC, series of Narnia adaptations. I haven't gone back, but I thought they were great as kids. I think that's actually how you do series of unfortunate events. If you just did like hour-long dramas for each book, do it in a quite, you know, firm British style. Yeah, even though they're actually American books.
They are American, but I think the humour is probably a bit more suited.
Well, but, I mean,
obviously it depends on the director. It doesn't matter what nation you do it in.
It's non-specific nationality and non-time. Yeah. I mean, it is in this completely
bizarre world.
All
right. Well, just one more that I want to sneak into franchises is an interesting one. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo.
Oh, yeah.
Now that I have read the first Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, seen all of the Swedish or Norwegian, whatever they are, seen all of them, and seen...
They're
Swedish?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I don't care. Well, no offense to Swedish or Norwegian people, but because you're obviously listening to us. But I have also seen the American one, which looks now like it will be the only one they make, which is a shame because I thought the book was fucking abysmal. It is the most straightforward. It's like, then Lisbeth did this. Then she hacked into this. Then she tattooed I'm a sadist pig into his chest. Like, it is so terribly done. And like the original Norwegian or fucking whatever the European
Swedish.
I don't think it's Swedish.
It is Swedish. Okay. It's set in Sweden.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's
look
right.
It up now.
Yeah, you know, that's right. Of course. Yeah, but then the Swedish one is just really it doesn't take as many liberties, I don't think, just with the original work.
Yeah, which it needs to. Which it needs to, because it's an airport novel.
It is a bit shit. And then Finch's one, which is written by Steve Zalian, who's done a lot over time, and the incredible, incredible title sequence. Jesus Christ, that is the bomb. But basically, I did find it odd that they kept it completely localized with American actors doing Swedish accents,
which is
a bit dodgy. And then getting like Stellan Skarsgård, who's the local American kind of like gun for hire for any European role ever, which I always find really funny. I just really enjoyed it, particularly the sequence where she tattoos him and fucks with him. That is so good.
What else can you do?
I did really like it. I really liked it. Just because of that scene. I thought that was incredible.
It's a good look. I mean, it's David Fincher and he's got a cast and obviously the elements there for him. But I mean, the story is just...
I saw the American film first and then I read the book and then... No, wait, no. I actually read the book side by side with the Swedish trilogy. So basically, I just took it on the terms of it being told to me by a really, really good filmmaker and a really good script, and I didn't have any problems with the story.
No, I think the story is terrible. It's just a badly paced movie because you just introduce this political conspiracy at the start, have an English powerhouse, like an Agatha Christie novel in the middle, and then wrap up the first story at the end, and it's just terrible. But the thing is, I think that speaks to what I like to call the SBS effect, which is everything is more intelligent if it has subtitles. Is like this effectively an airport novel like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo when made in Swedish. It's, you know, it's what the intelligentsia watch in Sweden. And, you know, so I don't know. I think that's an interesting example because I definitely thought
the American film was better because it wasn't a remake for a start. No, it was an actual adaptation.
It's not a remake. Yeah, I agree.
So just getting. I think that's franchise as well.
this is kind of not an adaptation, but another example is the Infernal Affairs remake, The Departed.
Mm.
I mean, it's like, it's a remake. It's an American remake, and I know that kind of sets off this stupid in people's heads, but Christ, it's Martin Scorsese.
Yeah.
You know, you just go...
Also did another pretty good remake called Cape Fear. You know, he's all right.
That's not as good as The Departed, though. Right. and I just think, you know, who cares about... You know, I'm not interested in that case. It's about who's doing it. In this case, it's David Fincher. Mm. Even though I really think that is one of David Fincher's weaker works.
Sure, yeah. No, I can agree with that. Yep. But it is one of the few David Fincher works I've seen in a cinema. So for that reason, it did kind of have a pretty big impression on me.
Yeah. Well,
but, you know, okay, sure, whatever. But
Zodiac, motherfucker.
Yeah, that's a good point. But so yeah, moving on from the franchise, kind of, I kind of want to push it in the direction of just a kind of a the unfilmable. We haven't done the main unfilmable, which is of course Alan Moore.
Well, no, actually, James Joyce is more unfilmable than
Alan. Okay,
Moore.
No. Okay, sure, but the one who wants to
be film least.
The ones and the one who's had a fair amount of films made of his book. So of course, let's just kind of like Watchmen first, you know.
Well, I mean, V for Vendetta first because it's made first. Yeah.
And I liked it. I've read parts of the graphic novel, but I'm not much of a graphic novel reader. You are, so.
Well, I mean, Alan Moore's central problem with the film is that it's it reduces fascism and. I think his central problem is that it's very much it's tied so strongly to Thatcherism in that time in Britain.
And it's made by Americans. It's written by the Wachowski brothers,
and it's turned into, you know, like so many of those films, a post 9/11, you know, Bush Jr. allegory, which I think a lot of people, I think that's a cliche that as an English writer, I'd be pretty pissed off about.
Yeah.
And Alan Moore,
and also the actual politics of an Alan Moore graphic novel, and never going to make it into a film because
he's an Atticus magician, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, exactly.
Of course not. Mm. And furthermore, the problem with I think the offense that Alan Moore takes, and I kind of agree with him, is this is a man who's dedicated his life to legitimizing and strengthening and making unique his craft, and these Hollywood adaptions are kind of demeaning that in a way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And with Watchmen, though, it's taken to a new level.
Yeah.
Because Watchmen, I think, you know...
And I have read...
Yeah.
I have read Watchmen.
I think Watchmen isn't just a great... I mean, I think as just a work of art, the original graphic novel is...
Amazing.
A complete masterpiece.
Some things in there, like, it is so visual, and I think that's why people would have gone, oh, well, let's make a film, because it is visually very accomplished, but
it's visual as a graphic novel. I mean, Alan Moore just very simply broke it down and said, look, you can't... You can't adapt Watchmen because fundamentally you need the time to take in each panel.
Mm.
And that was his problem, is it's so the subtleties of it.
Yeah, intricate.
You can't at that moving at that speed. If each panel is a frame in a storyboard, it's just gone like that.
Yeah, and even just like the fact that like the frames are side by side and you can kind of look from one and back to the other.
And of course there's the famous chapter within Watchmen, Fearful Symmetry, which is symmetrical.
Yeah, like,
you don't get that in you can't get that in film.
And of course the fact that it was handled by Zack Snyder doesn't help.
And beyond that, it's an awful film in its own right, because...
And speaking of like details being lost that you... like can't really understand something that's going on because they didn't tell you what's going on, and if you haven't read the original material then you won't understand.
And also because I think, you know, what I like about Watchmen is you've got the tale of the Black Freighter, which takes a while to really understand why it's there, and then you've got the watching of the television of the artist, so it sort of speaks to the power of fiction when they kind of stage that big monster, you know, to tap into primal fears, and that's kind of, you know, it's like it sort of is a bit of a reflection on Pulp Fiction and comics, etc. And then to get rid of that undermines so much of the story. Yeah. But beyond that, there's just so much of the film is awful, like the sex scene.
It's completely different audience in a way.
And the violence is so gratuitous. And that takes... I say that. There's like, that's probably one of the three films where I'll say the violence is gratuitous. Because it takes a lot for me to say that. But God, the violence in that film just...
What are your other two?
I don't know.
Off the top of your head? No, okay.
I'm sure there's only... Yeah. That's... Mm. Oh, what's the other one?
Is it an adaptation? We can... But no. From moving from that to another... something that I kind of see to be unfilmable. Not unfilmable, but a particular tone that is achieved in the novel that I... don't think a film can... Well, could, but, you know, probably need a better director, was this The English Patient. And I've read the book and I've seen the film, and I really, really, really just, I'm not a fan of the film, and had seen it first and just couldn't understand why certain things were happening. And I was just a bit bewildered as to, like, well, why all of a sudden is this going on, and why are they talking? Why are all of a sudden are they saying goodbye and are so close, and what's going on here? The book is really good. And just, like, so many, just, like, I really like Michael Ondaatje, who also wrote In the Skin of a Lion, which I really liked as well, which is another pretty unfilmable thing, but they probably put their hands on it and just fuck it up. But he actually just has this really, really beautiful writing style, and the story comes through, and you can actually go, oh, it is an incredible story, which I completely missed in the film.
Mm.
And it's so much about just, like, those interpersonal kind of moments.
Yeah.
And just kind of, like, deep kind of, like... It's like, you know, she couldn't explain why she felt attracted to his fat belly. Just like all this kind of stuff, which you cannot do.
And this is what I don't get about how the hell Joe Wright is going to do Anna Karenina. Because it's so much about, you know.
Yeah.
And Levin sat in the snow and contemplated the glorious divine feelings he felt towards Kitty. And how he would reconcile this with his plans for the peasants. And,
spoiler alert.
yeah.
But yeah, you know.
Levin has problems.
Yeah, yeah. So, but also, you liked 1984, didn't you?
Yeah, but I think that's a.
I don't think it works.
I think it works, but I mean, it works as well as it can. I think it's never going to be as good as the book. It's as good as it's going to be. Mm. It's fine. I mean, I don't think there's much there. I think the last film that's worth talking about is American Psycho.
Okay, yeah, because, of course, Bret Easton Ellis, the book was famously banned just about everywhere, and it was in that wrapping, like, you couldn't touch it.
I bought it on my 18th birthday.
Oh, wow. Yes. There you go.
Even though I doubt anyone at my local bookstore was policing it, but just for the hell of it, I thought, well, I can buy a book.
Yeah, get ID'd for a book. Like,
I know.
Nice. But basically, yeah, that film is in, because it is directed by a woman, and I think that was, like, he tried to shut it down before they even got into production because it was being directed by a woman, and he was just being this.
Is that true? Really?
Yeah, it's Mary Harron. It's Mary Harron, and he was like, well, you know, Bret Easton Ellis is contrary at the best of times, so you know.
Yeah. I think American Psycho is a very successful adaptation.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, you can't really...
It keeps the heart of the book, but stakes its own, you know, claims its own territory, and...
It moves away from it.
Yeah, but with... I mean, for one thing, when he does it, it's a period... When they do it, it's a period movie, and it's a very good one. And I think it would have been so easy to ignore that, but they kept it as such, and it's so much stronger for it.
Mm.
And the black humour shines through much more. I mean... They give up on the more shocking moments of violence. There are no rat moments.
Well, because it'd be a different, kind of film.
Well, really. it would just, but I
turn into a gore, less of a black humor thing.
And I just don't think you need to film that. I think,
And that's a good thing about film is that you can, like, the unshown is potentially as powerful as what is shown. And I think also just those scenes like, do you like Huey Lewis?
Yeah.
Just knowing what's about to happen, they're incredibly tense and, like, hilarious because of it. Because you know what's coming. You don't have to have read the book to know what's coming.
And that's such a great way of staging his inner monologue,
essentially. Oh, yeah.
I mean, they don't pack in because it's such a subject... You know, it's a similar thing. It's that unreliable narrator, the very textual book. And they just... They do it in a really efficient and simple and unpretentious way, which is simply staging these scenes that play up the contrast in the character, you know, really straightforwardly and really effectively.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even though of the films we've mentioned, it's not necessarily my favourite, even though I like it very much, American Psycho is a great how-to on adapting the quote-unquote unadaptable novel.
And it's interesting noting that they are remaking it.
Well...
And with a director, writer-director who hasn't done anything of note yet, which is, I mean, I'm interested to see how it goes.
Yeah.
And everything. So also, just quickly, another unfilmable novel, which is apparently in production or in pre-production while he gets his shit together, so we might be waiting a while, is James Franco is doing As I Lay Dying, writing and directing As I Lay Dying by William Faulkner, which is just... It's you know, it's a novel from how I don't know how many different points of view of the same incident, and that's the point of it. So what's he going to do, like a Rashomonic kind of telling of this story when he doesn't really have any chops as director, as proven by The Broken Tower, where he made a movie based on a poet's life and just used his poetry as voiceover, showing that he doesn't really understand, like, a film. Like, oh yeah, no, instead of doing visual poetry, I'll just read his poetry and voice over and have really stale, boring images going with the rest of it. So,
and,
like,
and that's
and I'll chuck a fellatio scene in there so I get called arty. Like, it's, he doesn't really have any idea what he's doing, or he's pulling the wool out over our eyes until he actually does something good, which I very much doubt. So yeah, that's my call for next shit film.
And that's another great overarching lesson of adaptation.
Don't give James Franco money.
No, just don't, like, if when you're having trouble, and this isn't a problem with the tone, when you're having trouble making it, don't just read the book in the film.
Yeah.
That's a brick wall.
And that's Cosmopolis last year. Like, I saw this interview with Cronenberg where he's like, oh, I was just reading it and it seemed very, very cinematic. I was like, what? They're just conversations for 2 hours. Like,
yeah.
Sitting in one spot for 2 hours having conversations with six different people. It doesn't really... I mean, I liked Cosmopolis, but because it was uncinematic in a lot of ways. Like, that was the novelty of it for me. So, yeah. But just to mention some that did go right. Apocalypse Now. We're very far from the book, but...
Yeah.
It is brilliant.
I think it's also... I mean... It's not actually... This isn't actually what the process is, but it's not so much... Wouldn't Vietnam be a great way to explore Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness? Wouldn't Heart of Darkness be a great scaffold to explore the Vietnam War? It's actually... And that's arguably, I think, a more organic way of doing that.
Absolutely,
you have an idea and you can frame it around a prior story.
Mm. And I mean, it's so... I mean, you kind of have to give a bit of poetic license for, like, the entire kind of institution with the... And Dennis Hopper's character, like, up there with...
Yeah.
Like, that's so... Like, you wouldn't make a documentary of that, whereas something like Platoon, the other... It's just a great thing in the Vietnam War pantheon, I think. It's just such a unique thing and it's so artfully done. And it's one of those things that is taken from, like, a historical kind of context, but just artistic license just taken all the way. And that is one thing that you can definitely say about it. It really just uses up any room left on the artistic license.
Yeah.
So, you know, I really, really do love that. I think those films that are that kind of internal monologue, that is, and I mean, just taking, like, When in Doubt, Don't Go to the Book. One thing I find is that film noirs based on books can are really, really, really problematic, because a lot of that kind of internal monologue, and you're just like, well, what the fuck do we do here? Because I'm gonna walk around this place and look for a clue. Like The Big Sleep is a great book and I really enjoyed it, and I think Chandler is a really good writer, and he actually co-wrote Double Indemnity, which is part of why I think the script alone is just incredible.
Mm.
But just the film is one of the noir films that I find is completely lacking, because you can't just go to voiceover whenever you need a storytelling device.
You can't. It does
hurt the film, I think. You know, another just, you know, but
yeah, well, I think that's true, but I think we should wrap this up.
Yeah, we probably should. Just really quickly. Okay, the trial rules.
Yeah,
Orson Welles moves away from the original kind of...
Not really.
He does kind of take a little bit of...
A bit.
He can't help because he's Orson Welles.
I think it's relatively faithful for what it is.
Yeah, but that's one of my favourite films, so I just wanted to get that in there. So, yeah.
Yeah, all right. I think that's it.
That's pretty much what we got to say, so yeah.
CavaliersDoCinema@gmail.com.
Yep.
And this podcast is being adapted into a four-part BBC documentary.
Wow, there we go.
Yes, okay. Get it? It's meta humour.
Yay! Ooh. Yay, Sawo!
And now to play us out the theme from Atonement.
Have a good one.
Have a good one.